Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 123, I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Flavio Resende from the University of Montreal. We discuss what it means to have a big toolbox as a retinal surgeon and the importance of surgical versatility. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Flavio Resende. Dr. Resende is Associate Professor of Ophthalmology at the University of Montreal, where he serves as the Surgical Retina Fellowship Director at the same University of Montreal. Dr. Resende, thank you for joining us from across the border.
You're welcome.
Thank you. No, it's great to have you. And so I'm going to talk about a little bit about when I first met you. You probably don't remember, but I'm going to tell you a little bit. But first thing, you're a new guest to the program. And so we have a lot of residents and fellows who listen, so it's always interesting to hear. So why did you decide to become an ophthalmologist and then a retina specialist?
So I actually went into medicine because I wanted to be an ophthalmologist. So this is something that runs in my family. I'm originally from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. I actually grew up breeding ophthalmology, so that's why I decided to do ophthalmology. And the reason why I decided to do retina is because of my father, well, recognition, and he gave me the same name as he has. I was very intimidated by him, and I wanted to try to find what was the hardest thing that I could do to detach me from him, and I found retina.
And then how did you end up in Montreal?
So I came to do my surgical retinal fellowship. So I spent 3.5 years here in Montreal back early 2000. So I did my PhD and my surgical retinal fellowship in ocular oncology fellowship here. Then I went back to Rio. I practiced there for 6 years. And then a spot opened up in the University of Montreal, and I applied for it, and I got it. And that's been 9 years that I practiced in Montreal.
And I'm assuming you're multilingual, Portuguese, Francais, Inglés. Anything I'm missing?
Exactly. University of Montreal is Francophone university. So, yes, I had my English and my Portuguese, and I had to learn French. Yeah, so about 98% of the patients that I see and operate is in French. I communicate with them in French.
You know, you probably don't remember this because this was a dinner that was at ASRS maybe 5 years ago, but my co-residents and I were at this dinner. I think Kouros Rezai and Tim Murray were talking. It was probably a retinoz type dinner, and they were talking about surgical techniques, and you were actually sitting right by us.
Uh-huh.
And we talked a lot with you, and actually it was really, really nice for us. We were all residents at the time applying for retina. It was actually, you were very down to earth, you were very approachable, and you talked a lot about thinking outside the box during surgery.
Yeah.
And you're someone who's spoken about this at meetings, you know, about thinking outside the box. So for fellows who are listening, talk a little bit about what you mean when you talk about that, about being flexible.
All right. The thing is, the great majority of ophthalmologists, I think it's like a trend, they like to have control. And many times in the OR, what you don't have is control. Like for instance, cataract surgery, it's a very good surgery that we have nowadays. So the surgeons are used to have everything going well. And then when something happens, it's such a good surgery that they're simply not ready for the trouble. And what I try to teach our retina fellows is that you have to try to be able to get used to not getting used to. So the less you're used to a routine, obviously a routine is always healthy, but you got to be ready to pull out your, what I call the backpack. You know, you got to have the biggest backpack that you can have to bring to the OR, the best surgeon you're going to be. Because it's, I don't think it's about it, knowing how to deal with the complications, it's about knowing how to avoid them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the hardest thing to do. And it's kind of complex to say that, because if you don't have a routine, then you're more likely to have a complication. So thinking outside the box includes actually having a very large backpack that you bring to the OR, and every time there's something doesn't go exactly to your routine plan, you have to be able to go back to your backpack fast and get something out of it. And that's what I get from every meeting that I go. I get, oh, this is, you know, I have many retina friends attending that I don't understand why you go to all these meetings and stuff. And I don't go only to teach. I go to learn and to increase the amount of tools that I have in my backpack.
You know, my question is, you've staffed and taught fellows for many years now, and you're the fellowship director.
Yep.
What are the most common mistakes that you see fellows make, or not even mistakes, but things that maybe fellows don't realize early that you have to teach them? And we're talking about maybe more specific things during surgery.
I think it goes back to the backpack thing, because when you arrive, you either arrive with the wrong tools on your backpack, or your backpack is empty.
Right, exactly.
You don't know what you don't know. You know, and the more you think you know, the more dangerous you are.
That's true.
So that's probably one of the hardest thing in the beginning, is to understand, allow them to understand. You know, the more they come with other trainings, the harder it is to train them. The more fresh out of residency, the better, in my opinion. Because it may be harder to teach in the very beginning, but after it's easier because you're just filling up an empty backpack. Now, if you come in with the wrong tools, it's harder to empty the backpack and then to fill it up again.
Right, that's true. And you know, you've also been an innovator in the sense that you were one of the first people to do the Argus implant.
Yes.
And you're the first in Quebec to do it, and that's an example of a situation where you have tools coming in, but you've never done this procedure before you're proctored. Tell us a little bit about your experience doing the Argus and your thoughts on the technology.
Yeah, so I think I see the Argus surgery a little bit as a buccal vit in a tube, you know, a glaucoma shunt tube at the same time, because you have to have skills from all these three different procedures to be able to do one of those cases. And in the beginning, it can take up 4 to 5 hours to do a case, you know. So the other thing is endurance. A retina surgeon, one of the things that make them different than the other subspecialties in ophthalmology, you have to have endurance, because you never know when you're going for a quote-unquote quick 15 minutes, you know, macro case or vitreous opacity for that matter, and it becomes a mess, you know, detachment or whatever. You know, it's the great majority of times is much different than, let's say, anterior segment surgery. So the one of the first challenges of the Argus is endurance. You know, is knowing how to have different skill sets of different surgeries at the same time, and one after the other, you know, in one single case. And then there's the introduction of the tacking, which is actually an older step in the procedure back from the early 90s, but that we were not used to do that, and that's an extra step in the surgery while you have a fairly large device inside the eye. You know, so these were the main surgical challenges, and actually one of the biggest challenges that I had, it was choosing the right patients in the beginning, you know, because it's a kind of a first generation of, in my opinion, a new way of treating quote unquote, the blinding disease, the retinal dystrophy. I think there's going to be a space for all the, you know, stem cell genetics and retinal prosthesis, in my opinion, for treating those conditions. And just so you know, what you never know, you know, as a resident and as a fellow, you never know what's gonna take you to the next level. You know, so the way I started with the Argus, you know, I wanted myself to go watch Stanislao Rizzo in Italy, who, you know, he was the guy that had most mouse surgeries, Argus surgery, back in, I don't know how many years ago. So I went there, you know, I spent the whole day with him, and then so I watched the surgery. Okay, well, is that the procedure that I had never seen before? Only watch videos. It's not the same thing. So then I came back and said, well, that's what I want to do. So then, like 2 years later, I managed to bring the technology to Quebec. And, you know, there was a lot of media exposure because this was covered by the foundation of the hospital. So they wanted all the media exposure. And sure enough, there was a group from Australia that reached out. And nowadays, I'm working on a next-generation retinal chip with a group from Australia that I had never met before. You know, it was the department, the School of Physics from the University of Melbourne that reached out. So you never know where it's going to take you, whatever you're learning, especially during your fellowship.
No, those are great points. And, the last thing, you know, I wanted to talk to you about is people in the U.S. a lot of times, we view, you know, the Canadian medicine is very different, right, in terms of your access to the OR and what you're able to do. And so our Canadian colleagues a lot of times talk about pneumatic retinopexy. And so the last topic I wanted to talk about was pneumatics. You know, coming from Brazil, where I've heard there maybe aren't as many pneumatics done, but maybe that's incorrect. You know, adapting to doing pneumatics, and how often do you do them? Maybe what percentage of the cases you see that you do them, and any tips or pearls for U.S. physicians who may not do it that often in terms of how to start doing them and the things you can do with it. For example, do you do the cryo first? Do you do the laser later? What is your general approach for these patients?
Yeah, that's an interesting question that also illustrates the backpack thing. Because I probably one of the only retina specialists nowadays that made the exact opposite move. So I was in private practice in Brazil, and then I came to university-based practice in Montreal. Private practice, doing 6 years in private practice in Rio, I probably did 3 pneumatics, and that's probably the same amount of cases, if not more, that we do per week of pneumatics in Montreal. So we tend to say that every fresh detachment that walks in is a pneumatic until proven otherwise. And it works pretty much, overall indication is about 70%. So for us that don't have much access to the OR, if we're able to avoid 70% of the detachment to go to the OR, it's a great thing for us.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not able to practice search karate if we didn't have pneumatics, let's say, in a big referral center that we where we're based. So the way we did in pneumatic, the way I did in pneumatic, so anesthesia, I'm more comfortable doing peribulbars than only subconch. I don't like the pain associated with the cryo and the injection of the gas. So I myself do peribulbars, but I'm the only one that does peribulbars, and most of my guys, they do subconch. Usually most of us, we do the cryo first before injecting the gas bubble. And I usually do the cryo only to mark the breaks. You know, so I try to do a cryo spot at the interior edge of the break,
mm-hmm.
which is going to be the hardest one to reach with the laser after the retina reattaches through the gas. Because if you elect not to do the cryo and do only the laser post-op, many times you have a really hard time to find the breaks. after the retina is attached and the gas is in the eye. And it's important that you do the PEXI before the gas goes away, because otherwise most of the time it's going to re-detach, right? And probably one of the nicest pearls that I have for pneumatic is to do, to try to determine preoperatively if there's what kind of PVD the patient has. So you can do a combination of V-scan and ideally strep-source OCT, and you can most of the time tell if you have a partial or a complete PVD. In a partial PVD setting, we have a publication many years ago that demonstrated that prospectively, if you do a pneumatic and the patient has a partial PVD, the success rate is only 30%. And on the other hand, if you have a complete PVD, meaning if the vitreous is detached from the disc and or the macular area, that success rate goes up to 90%. So that kind of explains why in the literature you have such a broad success rate for pneumatic retinopexy, is because nobody actually assessed for PVD before doing it. So you have, you know, just by chance, you have most of your cases that had a complete PVD, you have a slam dunk pneumatic, sometimes even with the patient not positioning, because the traction has already been released, you just want to reattach the retina. And on the other hand, if you have a partial PVD, you still have continuous traction, and that's when many times you find new breaks post-pneumatic. You know, it's because the vitreous is still attached to some other areas posteriorly. And you inject the gas level, you just increase the traction rather than release it.
How much does the phakic status play a role in your decision-making?
The phakic status, it's usually easier to examine the periphery. That's pretty much, you know, help. But there's different types of RDs in pseudophakes. So if it's a recent pseudophake, it may behave as a phakic eye. So it may have been a PVD-induced break. So you have like a flap tear, which is a more posterior break, and then you can treat exactly like you do in a phakic eye. Now, if the patient had cataract surgery a long time ago, then they behave more like a tiny peripheral tears that it's really hard to see depending on the peripheral opacities of the capsule bag. So it varies. It depends on what kind of pseudophakic we're dealing with. You know,
right.
The more most recent, the more likely they are to be similar to a phakic patient, so a better candidate.
And then what type of gas do you prefer and what volume do you typically try to inject?
So that will depend on the size of the eye and if the patient has glaucoma, previously not have glaucoma, or has a bigger excavation. So if you have a larger cupping at the disc, or if it's a smaller eye, then I tend more to inject C3 and I inject 0.3. But otherwise, my go-to is SS6, 100% of course, and it's 0.6 ml. And that's because the gas goes away faster. So I have a bigger bubble faster, and it goes away faster. So the patient can go back to his regular activities, if everything goes well, within 1 week to 10 days.
No, that's perfect.
Yeah.
And then my final thing, how often do you deal with altitude issues in your area? I know Montreal can be kind of a referral center in for a lot of Quebec.
Yes.
How do you handle that with patients who may need a pneumatic? Do you just tell them to wait if you're doing SF6, or what do you decide to do?
Yeah, many times the patient doesn't know what's the altitude, because up to a certain altitude, they can go without much of a problem if they rise slowly. You know, the problem is going higher, and as a quick ascent, that's when the gas becomes a big problem. So when they don't have any idea about this, and they are coming from far, either I have them waiting in Montreal, or if they have a total PVD, that's another big advantage. You can even inject air. Sometimes you can get away with a bigger air bubble, and 2 days later, you know, you can laser and it can they can go back to their original place. So it is a very important question that if you do live nearby mountains or patients are coming from abroad, so that's a very important question to ask. You know, are you flying in? There's a big population in Quebec. Do they go to Florida for during the summer, right? And so that, you know, sometimes they have to fly back for their post-ops. If they have gas in the eyes, it's a huge problem. So you got to be, it's one of the things that in the medics, you have to know where the patient's coming from and what kind of timing that they have to stay around. And the other thing that I didn't mention was the laser post-op.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so ideally, indirect laser is the way to go. Now, if you don't have, then you with the slit lamp, you can, you know, with these newer, smaller, wide field lenses, you can get pretty far in the periphery, especially if you use the gas bubble as a lens inside the eye. You know, if you tilt the head of the patient using the gas to go further into the periphery, most of the times you can get away on a slit lamp laser.
Yo, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Resende. My last question, I don't want to get you in trouble with anyone, but what's your favorite retina meeting to go to? So if you're a retina specialist out there, what is the one that you look forward to the most?
Well, I really like the smaller meetings, the meetings that we, you know, like the Vic Buckle meeting, the Club Vit meeting. There are some smaller meetings that are really, really, really nice, but it's harder for you know, the younger ones to leave their program to go for the smaller meetings. So I would say if you have only one meeting to go, ASRS is the one that I recommend because we're here in North America.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time and for coming on the program, and hopefully we'll see you soon at one of the meetings.
All right, man. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 123 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. I've gone back and listened to some of the older ones. Still very, very educational. So again, even if you've listened to them in the past, we'll be posting a list of some of our favorites, but those are all available for free, both on the website and in the podcast app of either your iPhone or Android. Remember, you can subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as in the Google Podcast app. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and you can contact us on Facebook or by clicking the Contact Us link on our website. You can also email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback about things we can do better and things we are already doing well. Anyone who's already left a review in the iTunes Store, we really appreciate it, and further reviews really are helpful as we go forward. Many thanks to Dr. Resende for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benincasa, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.